Chapter 18. "Your aircraft," Saley announced, releasing the controls. The Dobra was on autopilot, cruising at only 15,000 meters altitude as measured by humans. Every system had operated perfectly in the flight, including the replacement thruster unit. The only way to test the thruster to its full capabilities was at high altitude, up where the air was so thin that thrusters were needed to control the gunship's flight.
"Take us up."
"Yes, ma'am," Derek acknowledged as he deactivated the autopilot and set the controls for the airspeed and altitude that allowed a maximum climb rate. The Dobra zoomed toward the upper edge of the atmosphere, where its engines strained to gulp in enough air to keep the aircraft aloft. Soon, the wings began to lose lift, and Derek needed to push the nose down to maintain airspeed, or the thin air flowing over the wings would cause a stall. A Dobra could hover at up to 20,000 meters. Already, he had the engine pods pointed down slightly so their thrust helped keep the gunship aloft. "Losing roll control," Derek reported as the wings began to wobble. He had not been this high other than in a simulator for over a year. The Ruhar aircraft flew like a dream. The controls were light and responsive. The ship did everything he asked of it and told him there was more, so much more that it could do and was eager to do. Even at this extreme altitude with the engine straining, when he touched the throttle, he could feel there was reserve power he had not used yet. If he had not been concentrating so hard on the instruments, he would have had a moment to realize this was the happiest he had been in months. Coming to Paradise, once something Derek had burned with patriotic fervor to do, had become a nightmare. UNEF was trapped. Not even the Kristang had access to Earth. The expeditionary force were all prisoners of war, forced to grow their own food. Their allies, the Kristang, had been revealed to be cruel deceivers, caring only about using UNEF and enslaving humanity. Duty for UNEF was now all about survival on a planet with the Ruhar in charge. Now the Kristang were back, and survival might not be possible. If Derek had stopped to think about that, he would plunge into despair. So he thought only of how joyous it was to fly this powerful alien fighter aircraft high above an alien planet. The roll was getting worse. A Ruhar pilot, with their genetically enhanced reflexes, might have been able to keep ahead of the aircraft's shuddering, but Derek needed help to halt the rolling tendency before it snapped the Dobra over on its back. He consoled himself with the thought that the purpose of going this high was to test the thruster unit, which he now needed. "Engaging thrusters to stabilize." Saley looked at her instruments to monitor the performance of the new thruster unit, which was not actually new. It was a rebuilt unit that had been recovered from a Dobra shot down by her own people, back when a human had been flying the doomed aircraft and the Ruhar fleet came back to retake control of the planet. She would have preferred a truly new thruster unit, but of course, spare parts were no longer being shipped to Gatanu. The thruster was operating perfectly, and Derek had confident control of the aircraft, so she took her eyes away from the instruments for a glance out the canopy. Up this high, the sky was black, and the curve of the planet below was noticeable. It looked so peaceful. The land to the north, so green. The ocean below them, so blue. The cloud tops, so brilliantly white. Above, her eyes caught sunlight reflecting off something, and she blinked to enhance the vision in her helmet visor. A Kristang ship. A big one. The image wobbled enough that she couldn't quite tell if that ship above her was the battle group's command ship, but she thought that likely. If she wanted, she could have viewed the image from one of the Dobra's cameras, but she did not care to see the enemy ship that closely. Her eyes turned back to the instruments, so she missed by a nanosecond the intense white flare coming up from the planet's surface. She knew that she shouldn't look toward a maser beam, but her instincts made her look briefly before her training took over. So she didn't miss the projector's second shot, or the even brighter fireball of that Kristang cruiser exploding. "Engage stealth," Saley ordered calmly as she was momentarily blinded by the intense light of the maser burning its way up through clouds. "Take us down on the deck." Derek did not hesitate. He had not seen the initial maser shot, but caught the second beam out of the corner of his eye. Immediately he had closed his eyes and looked away, so his vision was unaffected. The first thing he did was activate the stealth field, and the bright sunlight coming in through the canopy disappeared as a curtain of darkness draped over the aircraft. From now on, he would be flying entirely on instruments, which did not bother him. When the stealth field had been powered up, Long, thin wires had extended from each wingtip and the tail. The ends of the wires peeked out beyond the stealth field and provided sensor data. The canopy automatically switched over to provide a view, a composite image of what the sensors said were outside. He did not make the mistake of reducing power, for at that altitude, the Dobro would have stalled and gone into a spin. Thrusters could have recovered from the spin, which the aircraft would have done automatically. But with a shooting war going on above his head, Derek had been trained to reserve thruster fuel. He pointed the Dobra's nose down and felt his body moving upward against the seat straps as the gunship hit the top of the arc, and he was momentarily weightless. Then the sensation of weight gradually returned, and he concentrated on keeping airspeed to VST, the speed for maximum stealth. He had to run the engines at almost minimum power and monitor airflow over the wings so the Dobra passed through the atmosphere as smoothly as possible. The problem with using stealth in an atmosphere was that enemy sensors could track him by the warm, roiling air behind the Dobra. If he had to engage in air combat, stealth would be almost a liability. The engines would be putting out enough heat and turbulent air that he might as well hold up a sign saying, "Shoot me." With the aircraft in a stable descent trimmed for optimal stealth, Derek had time to scan the sensors and assess the situation. He had just turned his attention to the tactical display when another Kristang ship overhead exploded, or a piece of a ship had exploded, because he could run the display back and see that ship had been struck by a powerful maser beam in the initial strike. Stunned, Derek toggled the display back and expanded the coverage for a wider area. He gasped with shock when he saw what the sensor data revealed. The Kristang battle group in orbit had been hit hard by four powerful maser cannons on the surface. Maser cannons. "You hit the Kristang!" "Yeah!" Derek shouted and pumped a fist toward the canopy. "Thank you!" "That wasn't us," Sally responded tersely. It was the first words they had exchanged since the attack began. She had been monitoring the sensors and communicating with the airbase to find out what in the hell was going on. No one had answers. Ruhar Command appeared to be as surprised as anyone. "We don't have projectors like that. If we did, we would have used them when the Kristang were raiding us." "Not you? Then who?" Derek asked, completely confused. "It's not us, is it? UNEF?" "No, not humans either. I do not know what is going on. Cut the chatter," she ordered. Derek cut the chatter and turned his focus back to the sensors. He suddenly realized that since the start of the crisis, Saley had trusted him with complete control of the aircraft. Her aircraft. "We've been ordered to return to base," Saley announced. "On course," Derek acknowledged. He had assumed that was where Saley wanted to go, so they were already flying in that direction. The check ride was clearly over. Saley must have been happy with his flying because she didn't say anything to him for several minutes. Still flying with maximum stealth, they crossed the shore and were now over land. At their present slow airspeed, the base was 47 minutes away. Derek checked status of the weapons, which Saley had not enabled yet. As a human, Derek knew he was not trusted with weapons. They would return to the airbase, and Saley would likely be reprimanded for flying with an unauthorized weapons system officer. Derek's flying days would be over. It was likely he would soon find himself tending crops in Lemuria. And he didn't care. The Kristang battle group was gone. With many of their ships obliterated by powerful maser cannons, they would think very carefully about approaching the planet again. They were free. Humans were free, or at least free to be prisoner of war under the Ruhar. Derek no longer felt a constant fear of a Kristang sword hanging over his neck. "No matter what else happened, they..." "My aircraft," Saley said curtly, and the control stick went slack in Derek's hand. "Roger that," he replied, and mentally switched back to Wizzo mode. Since the main battle group had arrived to take control over Perdassus, the Swift Arrow Clan frigate, to seek glory in battle is glorious, had been relieved of her dangerous raiding duties because there were to be no more raids. A ceasefire was in effect, a ceasefire with generous conditions that had shocked the crew of the Glory when they heard about it. Why Admiral Kikrondo had made so many concessions to an enemy whose position was so weak, almost no one in his battle group could understand. Kikrondo had sent a message to all ships that he was following strict instructions from clan leadership. The clan leaders strongly desired a negotiated agreement for the cowardly and treacherous Ruhar to leave Perdassus, Kikrondo had explained, his voice almost choking with outraged disgust as he read the words. Unsaid but implied was that the Swift Arrow Clan's resources were stretched very thin at the moment. With the prospect of a civil war within the Kristang looming, the clan could not afford to support a protracted battle for Perdassus. The cowardly Ruhar civilian government had already agreed to the concept of abandoning, surrendering, the world their military had fought very hard for. All that remained was for the two sides to agree to a price, and now that Kakrondo's powerful battle group had established total supremacy in the space on and around Perdassus, the Swift Arrow leaders were confident they could ultimately get the entire planet for a cheap price. The question of why the Swift Arrow clan wanted a world whose chief product was grain had never been stated. Most of the warriors in the battle group had never been to the backwater world of Perdassus before, and what they saw was not impressive. Looking down at a world dotted here and there with the parallel stripes of agricultural fields, most of the ship's crew considered that the real reason they had been sent on a one-way mission was to uphold the honor of their clan and their entire species. Because there was no other conceivable reason why the clan leadership had sent so much of the clan's precious combat power to such an unimportant planet. The clan leadership was wise, Kakrondo had stated in an unconvincing tone. The brave warriors of the battle group needed to have faith in their leadership and concentrate on executing their mission to the greater honor and credit of the clan. When the crew of the Glory heard Kakrondo's speech, the little frigate's captain had turned to his executive officer and muttered the Kristang equivalent of blah, blah, blah. Words were passing things, and it mattered not why the battle group was here. What mattered was the mission that had been assigned to the battle group, to each ship and to each crewman. The current mission assigned to the Glory, each and every one of her crew agreed, sucked. It sucked big time. It could have sucked a bowling ball through 50 feet of garden hose, that's how badly it sucked. After taking enormous risks as the chief raiding ship before the bulk of the battle group arrived, the Glory's crew had expected a nice, cushy assignment. The frigate would tie up next to a support ship they expected for extended maintenance and repairs. Maintenance that was long overdue. While engineering teams worked feverishly to bring the frigate back up to full combat potential, most of the crew could enjoy some well-deserved shore leave on the planet they had been viewing from space for so long. But no. That was not their assignment. After the long journey to Perdassus, many of Kakrondo's heavy ships needed maintenance and replenishment, and those much more valuable ships were given priority attention by the support vessels. The battered, worn-out little Glory was given a lonely task, a task for which frigates had been designed. She was to shadow the Ruhar Commodore for Lant's remaining task force. And so, the Glory was positioned roughly 1 light-minute away from Ferlant's loosely clustered ships. 1 minute closer to Perdassus. Ferlant's ships had mostly been sitting in one spot since the ceasefire, licking their wounds and biding their time. Glory's captain considered that no matter how unhappy the warriors of the Swift Arrow Task Force were about their current mission, the Ruhar of Ferlant's Task Force had to be even more unhappy. They had failed. They had failed to protect their planet from damaging raids by a handful of isolated Kristang ships, and now they had completely lost control of the star system. What awaited Ferlant's crews was a humiliating wait for negotiations to conclude, and then a retreat with their tails tucked between their legs. If the Ruhar crews had been Kristang warriors, it would be a long time, if ever, before they could hold their heads in anything but utter shame. A Kristang would enthusiastically embrace death before enduring such dishonor. Or so the Kristang told themselves with bravado while they had such an overwhelming advantage in combat power around Perdassus. While their little ship performed its lonely picket duty, keeping an eye on Ferlant's impotent ships, the Glory's crew went about fixing up the ship as best they could. With the ship technically being constantly at battle stations, they could not take many critical systems offline for badly needed maintenance. So they did what they could and waited for relief. Surely Admiral Kakrondo's staff would send another frigate to replace the Glory eventually, and the ship could be returned to full combat capability. Surely that would happen soon.
"Signal received," the ship's communications officer shouted excitedly. "The order is option... green?"
The man sputtered in surprise.
"We are to execute immediately!"
Concealing his shock and resigned to his fate, the ship's captain gave the order with a calm due more to weariness than bravery.
"Execute Plan Green as soon as possible," he
he said sadly to his executive officer.
Yes, Captain,
the man replied quietly, and turned to engage the ship's poorly maintained jump drive system.
The condition of the drive is...
I know, the captain said without taking his eyes off the tactical display.
Do the best you can. We must jump as quickly as possible.
The best possible,
the executive officer said while studying the indicators for jump drive coil status.
We'll barely get there in time.
The signal from Pardassus had continued past the Glory and would reach the Ruhar task force in less than 1 minute. Presumably, the Ruhar on the planet had sent their own signal to Commodore for launch ships. If the Glory were to have any advantage of surprise, she needed to arrive in the midst of the Ruhar formation before the signal did.
Understood,
the captain acknowledged. He could read the drive status on his own display. He turned the attention to the officer monitoring the sensor console.
What happened down there?
Option green was one of five contingencies established by Admiral Cicrondo, with green being a plan to be activated only if the battle group somehow suffered a catastrophic loss. How could that have happened? The officer had been frantically pushing buttons and spinning dials. Confused and shocked, he looked up from the console.
Captain, it appears the Ruhar violated the ceasefire. They attacked our battle group using projectors.
Projectors?
The captain exchanged an astonished look with his executive officer.
You are certain?
The Glory's sensors were in poor condition and far overdue for important components to be replaced. There must be a mistake. A sensor glitch.
Yes, Captain, there is no mistake. I can clearly see three projectors firing, and another is behind the curve of the planet's horizon.
Projectors, the captain repeated. When did the Ruhar install projectors? How? They did it right under our noses?
Fleet intelligence will have a difficult time explaining this,
the executive officer noted.
We have lost 11 ships so far, including the Victorious. She was struck first. The attack is continuing. Or it was,
he added, remembering that the light picked up by the ship's sensors was now several light minutes old.
11 ships, the captain said, stunned.
This was indeed a catastrophic event. A disaster for the battle group and for the Swift Arrow clan. He now understood why Cicrondo ordered Option Green. The order called for the Glory to abandon her picket duty, jump into the midst of the Ruhar formation, and attack. Attack and cause as much damage as she could until she was disabled or destroyed. Option Green called for Little to seek glory in battle is glorious, to fight to the death. Her own death.
When we jump in, head straight for the Ruhar cruiser at maximum speed, he ordered the executive officer.
The man nodded soberly. Since the Glory could not survive the upcoming fight, she would truly seek glory by attempting to ram the Ruhar cruiser Rue Gastallo.
The clan will sing about the glory of our battle forever,
the executive officer said loudly so the entire bridge crew could hear clearly. Privately, he thought of the frigate's brothership. Every day is a good day to die in battle. That ship had died in battle already. Was this day, a very ordinary day until minutes ago, a good day to die? As good as any, the exec thought. Although he would have preferred some warning to mentally prepare himself.
Jump drive is ready, Captain, he announced. Engaging now.
Aboard his command ship, Rue Gastallo, Commodore Ferlant's mind was still reeling. What else could go wrong with this mission, he asked himself. It was supposed to be a simple and relatively easy assignment. The fleet had taken Gitanu away from the Kristang. With their losses elsewhere in the sector, the Theranin were in no position to support a Kristang effort to retain control of the star system. Unexpectedly, a handful of Kristang ships had stayed in the system and began raiding the planet. That was an annoyance, not a serious threat. Then the Kristang had inexplicably began shooting at the clients, the humans, and the chief administrator of Gitanu had informed Ferlant that his task force needed to protect the humans also. Ferlant's ships were already stretched thin protecting the northern continent of Tenturo. Extending coverage to the southern continent greatly strained his ship's ability to protect the Ruhar population and infrastructure on Tenturo. Then, just when Ferlant thought he had discouraged the raiders, the Kristang, out of nowhere, had arrived with an entire battle group. Ruhar Fleet Intelligence had assured Ferlant that there was no way the Kristang would or could reinforce their few ships near Gitanu. No way. There was no possibility that the Kristang would even be able to get weapons and spare parts to their ships. All Ferlant needed to do, Fleet Intelligence had told him, was to hang on until the Kristang ships fell apart. The impossible had happened, and Ferlant had barely escaped with his tiny force intact. Having an enemy battle group appear absolutely out of nowhere, to land practically in his lap, had been shocking enough. Moments before, he had received notice that projectors on Gitanu had destroyed much of the Kristang battle group. The message from the Ruhar government on the planet had screamed at him why Ferlant had violated the ceasefire, and why he had not informed the government about the defense capabilities of their own planet. After wasting a few precious seconds on paralyzing shock, Ferlant had replied that he knew nothing about any projectors on Gitanu, and why hadn't the government informed him? Then he ordered his task force to immediately begin dispersing according to Action Plan 3. Because some of his ships were undergoing running repairs, they could not initiate a jump until they switched to backup systems. Ferlant was holding his own cruiser back to cover the stragglers.
McMurrow reports ready for jump, Commodore,
a bridge officer behind Ferlant reported. Without turning away from the main tactical display, Ferlant acknowledged with a curt nod.
Wait until McMurrow's ship is confirmed successful. Then take us to the rendezvous.
Enemy ship jumped in. One frigate. It's that damned target Beta Glorious something, whatever its name is, the officer reported. That damned lucky ship that kept raiding us.
Ferlant's lip curled in a wry smile.
That little ship is annoyingly persistent, isn't she?
Commodore, if we turn to expose our starboard railgun battery, we could take that ship out with one shot, the officer suggested.
Yes.
Ferlant's eyes narrowed as he stared at the red symbol in the tactical display. That little enemy ship had been the bane of his existence. He could finally be rid of it with one shot.
You have permission to maneuver the ship.
By luck more than skill, the frigate's creaky jump drive somehow brought the ship into the Ruhar formation and miraculously less than 70,000 kilometers from the Ru Gastalo. Against the much larger and heavily shielded Ruhar cruiser, the Glory had no chance even for a suicide run, for the cruiser's weapons would pound the little frigate into space dust long before the Glory approached. Glory aimed her own maser cannons and fired, with the beams easily deflected by the cruiser's more powerful shields. The Glory had to turn more than 90 degrees to engage the Ru Gastalo, and by the time the frigate made the turn and began accelerating with maximum force, the executive officer noticed something odd. Where were the other ships of Commodore Ferlant's small task force? There were only two ships within the frigate's sensor bubble, and as he watched, a destroyer jumped away, leaving only the cruiser. As the Glory was rocked by direct maser fire from Ru Gastalo, the executive officer's fingers flew over his own console. The other ships had jumped away only moments ago. He could still detect strong residual jump signatures. The ship was rocked again.
Captain, he shouted a warning. Shields collapsing.
One more maser volley from Ru Gastalo and the Glory would be defenseless. She was still over 60,000 kilometers from the target. By the time the cruiser blew up the frigate's reactor, Glory would be too far away for the cruiser to be damaged by the explosion. The crew of the Glory would die without having struck a significant blow against their long-hated enemy. If today was indeed a good day to die, it was not a good day to find Glory in battle. The frigate would find only frustration and death, not Glory. Why was the cruiser not firing her railguns? At such short range, a single railgun round could easily penetrate the Glory's hull, bow to stern, and in a burst of gamma radiation, the cruiser vanished.
What happened? The exec asked himself. Captain, the enemy ship has jumped away. They all jumped away. We can...
He looked to the sensor officer for confirmation.
We might be able to follow one of the ships. Their jump signatures are very recent and strong.
Catching the sensor officer's worried look, the exec added,
Considering the condition of our sensors, we would be using guesses more than science to track an enemy ship, Captain.
No, the captain replied, suppressing a shudder of relief at having avoided death once again.
Our orders were to attack the enemy task force. It is now dispersed, and we are unable to follow.
Send a signal to the Green Rendezvous Point, the hopefully secret location where the battle group was to assemble. Inform them that the enemy task force has dispersed and request orders. The enemy received the news before we did, the captain declared with a mixture of regret and gratitude. Or, the executive officer said darkly, they knew the exact timing of their projector attack and fled away for safety. The Ruhar are both treacherous and cowardly, Captain.
The captain nodded silently, agreeing with the obvious wisdom of his executive officer's statement. To himself, the captain said a prayer. With the ceasefire now over, Kristang ships might again be called upon to raid Pradassus. This time, powerful maser cannons would be the primary threat to raiding ships. What could the battered little frigate do against a projector? Nothing, except to serve as target practice.
They are treacherous and cowardly, the captain observed. And apparently they are very, very clever.
At the Rue Gustalo's assigned Action Plan 3 primary jump point, the cruiser emerged in a gamma ray burst. She ejected quantum resonators to cover the tracks of her next jump, and as soon as the ship's jump drive was realigned, she jumped again to the secondary point. There would be three more jumps before she rejoined the task force, a precaution because Action Plan 3 assumed the enemy would be pursuing, chasing Ferlant's task force around the star system. The cruiser jumped again and proceeded away in a random direction at full thrust, waiting for her jump drive to recharge.
Jump successful, Commodore. No sign of pursuit. Commodore, may I ask why we did not fire railguns at that enemy frigate?
Ferlant turned away from the tactical display. This was an opportunity to provide coaching to the young officers of his staff.
That frigate has somehow survived against the odds, at times when it seemed certain her fate was sealed. Fate has determined this is not yet her time. I have learned that one should never argue with fate.
Admiral Cacrondo shouted in a frustration that felt like physical pain, and he quickly spun to find something, anything, that he could smash. His officers knew from long experience never to be close at hand when the Admiral was enraged, which happened frequently. The never-ending hero of the Admiral's staff was their lowest-ranking member, who had the task of sprinkling around the bridge things that broke in a satisfying but non-lethal manner. Electronic tablet? Yes. Pistol with fully charged energy pack that might explode if broken in just the right manner? No. Pistol with depleted energy pack that would give very satisfying sparks and, at worst, a few second-degree burns to an unlucky person on the bridge? Very much yes. It was a great system. A system that had worked many, many times over. The system had never been tested under such intensely stressful conditions. Cacrondo had been preparing for a war game, which was why he was aboard the destroyer We Are Proud to Follow the Shining Example of Combat Rifleman Tut Wasval Kedwala instead of his command ship, the He Who Pushes Aside Fear Shall Always Be Victorious, which was why he was currently alive rather than a random assortment of rapidly cooling subatomic particles. Cacrondo had wished to observe the performance of the Victorious, and the best way to do that was to get off that ship so its captain and crew did not have an admiral looking over their shoulders. Fortunately, he had already been able to observe the Victorious in high-tensity combat. Unfortunately, that combat action had told him nothing illustrative about the performance of that ship's crew, because the battle had been a sneak attack by a ground-based projector against an unshielded ship, and because the Victorious was no longer an organized collection of components that resembled a starship. Cacrondo repeated, shocked, enraged, and humiliated at the incomprehensible defeat he had suffered. What were projectors doing on Pradassus, of all places? Seeing a pistol in its assigned slot on a bulkhead, he pulled the lever to release it and threw the weapon to the deck. It broke in several pieces, and its power pack came apart, spewing sparks around the bridge. One spark hit the sleeve of the officer sitting at the destroyer's sensor station, where that officer was running an analysis of the projector attack over and over again, trying to comprehend what had happened. Instead of flinching as the hot metal burned through his sleeve and into the skin of his forearm, the officer merely brushed it away as an annoyance. He burned his fingers and distractedly put the throbbing fingers in his mouth. His attention never wavered from the display. Something about that further enraged the Admiral, plus the pistol breaking apart had not been as satisfying as it had been in the past. He reached over to one of his security staff, yanked the man's pistol from its holster, and fired at the sensor console. The console exploded, sending metal and composites flying around the bridge, some pieces even striking the Admiral. Because consoles were designed not to injure their operators, the sensor officer was not badly injured. He was knocked off his chair and came shakily back to his feet, with stars in his eyes, to see an angry Admiral pointing a smoking pistol at his face. The officer did not flinch. If Cacrondo wanted to kill him for any reason, there was nothing the officer could do about it. He and his family ranked too low in the clan hierarchy to even protest.
"Please, Admiral, if it serves the clan for me to die, then do it quickly, so the ship can pursue the enemy."
Cacrondo snorted, first with surprise, then with laughter.
"Ha! Give me another 100 such men, and I will conquer the galaxy!"
He flipped the pistol back to his guard, looked at the stricken sensor officer, and demanded,
"Well, what are you able to tell me?"
The sensor officer strode over to a secondary console and activated it with no mention of the nearly fatal incident.
"We were attacked by 4 projectors, Admiral."
"Only 4?
Cacrondo was surprised. During the vicious sneak attack, it had seemed like the entire planet below had sprouted projectors, spitting deadly maser fire up at his ships.
"Only 4, the man confirmed. "They are oddly clustered together. The enemy's coverage of the sky is poor, with only those 4.
4 active, you mean?" Cacrondo asked. "How many others?"
"No, Admiral, there are only those 4. The sensor data did not detect targeting signals from any other sources. 2 of the 4 projectors here and here," he indicated, "are nearly depleted. We can tell from the reduced power of their last shots."
"It cannot be possible that the enemy has only 4 projectors on the entire planet," the Admiral stated.
The officer did not back down.
"According to Clan Intelligence, Admiral, it cannot be possible that the enemy has even 1 projector on Pardassus."
Cacrondo looked at the man sharply to see if the Admiral was being mocked. No, the man had correctly directed his scorn at the Clan's intelligence group.
"Ha!" the Admiral snorted. "Only 2 projectors to worry about, eh? We will see about that."
"Admiral," the destroyer's captain took the opportunity to step in, "will we be pursuing the enemy ships?"
"Some of us will, Captain,"
Cacrondo replied.
"And some of our ships will be testing how many projectors the enemy truly has."